of preparation, we saw that everything that Christianity is expressed in a proper understanding of just three words, Jesus Christ Lord, and how important it is to keep each of these words in balance. This isn't a message, it's a reality. The Lord became Jesus so that at this moment he could be the Christ of my life and of your life. We're supposed to witness to what Jesus is doing for us, what we're experiencing him doing for us at this moment, so that in Jesus, God's power, God's kingship, the reality of God is entering our world, is entering our lives, is entering our hearts, is coming to save us. When Jesus did this first, born in Bethlehem, and when God's power actually crashed in completely to our history, because God had been entering our history ever since he began calling Abraham. But when the fullness of his power became part of our world, of our life, Jesus began to save in a way that was so different from the way others expected that we've always got to be aware that Jesus continues to want to save us differently from the way that we want to be saved. John the Baptizer, John the Baptist, sent a delegation to Jesus because, see, he expected God's Messiah, the one that God would set aside to save his people, to come and start really condemning and destroying sinners. And rather than doing this, Jesus was offering love and fellowship, real human friendship to sinners. So the baptizer sent a delegation saying, are you the one who is to come, or aren't you? The 12 follow Jesus, but they're getting more and more disturbed the more they're following him. They're not getting a deeper and deeper sense of peace with Jesus until the resurrection. They start getting an insight when Peter says, you're the Christ. But from that moment on, things really start going haywire for them. The moment that Peter sees this is the moment Jesus says, yes, and I'm going to save you by dying. And that must have, you know, just blew all the circuits in Peter's mind, because he wasn't programmed to be saved by one who died. He was programmed to be saved by one who would use power and glory. Jesus continues to act in our world. He continues to be real in our life through his Spirit. The kingship of God is not in the heavens up there. The heavens are the kingship of God. That's the reality of God acting, and that's in each of our lives, if we'll just be aware of it. The kingship is present. It's as completely present on the earth today as it was when Jesus in the flesh walked the earth. Today the kingship is present in those who are filled with the Spirit of Jesus, in his people. The group that we call, and the word is terrible because we have so many false notions of it, the group that we call the church. We can think of church as building. We can think of church as leaders, as clergy, as ministers, priests, popes, bishops, sisters. Rarely do we think of church as us, as all of us being equally necessary. But that's what the kingship is. Jesus still, as he operates in us, is not the Christ the world expects. The answers that the world wants are not the answers that his people, filled with his Spirit, will be offering the world. And so there'll always be a certain conflict and tension between what the world wants and how the world expects to be saved and what Jesus is offering us. The kingship of God, the Spirit of Jesus, is here. Therefore, the great day of the Lord, when God's power starts breaking in completely into man's history, has begun. The consequences of this are very significant for the way those who accept this Spirit live and for the mission that they receive from the Spirit, from the mystery that they experience. And what I'd like to share with you this evening, therefore, are glimpses of trying to look at the mystery of the kingship seen very, very often through the eyes of history, going back to that group first filled with the Spirit of Jesus and looking at their understanding of the mystery as far as they could grasp it, and then the history of how they lived it, seeing some of the tensions to help us understand that when we're touched by God, we don't become perfect, because the group back there very definitely didn't either. What I'd like first to share with you is the mission of God's people. When you begin to believe in Jesus and accept Him as your Christ, and you start experiencing His Spirit, what happens to you? What is your role on this earth? The church, the people of God, all those experiencing the Spirit very definitely have a mission. If you go back to the New Testament, the book that was produced starting 20 years after the resurrection of Jesus and continued to be written from the first to the last book to up to 100 years after Easter. The first part would be the letters of Paul. The very last thing would be the second letter of Peter, that most people feel was written anywhere from 100 to 125 years after Jesus died and rose. You'll find two views as to what our mission basically is. The early view would be pretty much in Paul and in Mark. And then the later view will be hinted at in Matthew, but really comes out in Luke. The first view is that Jesus has begun something in us. We're experiencing His Spirit. We know that something wonderful has begun. But at the same time, we're aware that evil, selfishness, sin, disorder, whatever word you want to use, is still part of our world. So what Jesus has begun isn't complete yet. Now we do know when we experience Jesus that He is victor. Our belief enables us to know that He's conquered these forces of disorder in Himself completely. So, the first view starts off fairly passive with a certitude that Jesus is going to return for us to complete what He has begun. That Jesus is going to re-enter our lives somehow. There's nothing more He can give us, but somehow He's going to perfect us in our ability to accept His Spirit, so that we'll never weaken, disorder will never be present to us again. When you really start experiencing, and to the degree that you start experiencing the Spirit of Jesus acting in you, you want more of it. You want to be at deeper peace with yourself, and you don't want these waves of depression that might come, however small they are, or anxiety, or fear, or disorder, or selfishness. You don't want them coming back in your life again. And if you can understand this, then you'll understand why the early church so eagerly waited for Jesus to return to complete what He had started. The echoes of this you'll find, we've shared this several times, so I don't want to take much time with it, in Paul's first two letters to the Thessalonians. They're eager for Jesus to come. They're all waiting around. Jesus has begun to come into their life. There are threats in their world, and they still go through certain moods in their own existence. They know they have the Spirit of Jesus, and yet problems come. And they want Jesus to come back and perfect what they're doing. So they're so eager, as I shared with you, some of them get upset that some friends are dying before Jesus comes back, and they're afraid that the ones who've died won't be here for Jesus to complete what He's begun. So Paul says, don't worry, the dead are going to share just as fully as you are in this perfecting that Jesus does. Then the second letter to the Corinthians, to the Thessalonians, some of them figured, well, if Jesus is coming tomorrow and He's going to perfect me, why should I work today? And Paul says, you better go to work. You know, it's expelling this out. The real eagerness that Christians had for Jesus returning showed in the way they would gather for worship. As far as we can guess, once a week, Saturday evening, possibly starting for two reasons, because the Sabbath had ended, and a person was only allowed to walk so far on the Sabbath if they were keeping the law of Moses. And their first journey would be to the synagogue. So when the Sabbath had ended with sundown, Christians would gather in private homes, and there they would begin the second reason it would be Saturday evening, because being Jewish, the Jews, now this is not all through the Bible, but for the Jews, a day begins with sunset. At sunset, the new day begins and lasts through the night until the following sunset. So, on the seventh day, which is Sunday, no, Saturday, yeah, I'm sorry. Everything that the Jews celebrate, so the seventh day is over, and now there is a, on the seventh day, the Jews celebrated because God had completed his creation and rested. But Christians are part of a new creation, and they gather on the first day of the new creation. We're not just celebrating what God gave us in the universe. We're celebrating what God is giving us on an entirely deeper level as he shares with us his own very life. On this same day, so God began on the first day, God began the first creation. On the first day, you have the resurrection. It was a Sunday. God really begins his new creation in a very real way as Jesus conquers death. And also on Sunday, so the Father starts his acting of the first creation on the first day. The Son starts his action of the new creation on the first day. And the Spirit makes this a reality for us because it is on the first day of the week, Pentecost, that the Spirit comes down and fills people. So, the Christians celebrated the first day of the week. They would gather over someone's home, and they would start off basically reading the Old Testament, because at first they have nothing of the New Testament. Then later reading letters that Paul had written to one community that were sent to them, and these letters were remembered in the other books of the Bible. Then when the sun came, they were gathering, preparing themselves to meet Jesus as he came from the east with the sun. And when the sun rose and Jesus was not coming, reluctantly, sadly, because they really wanted to be perfected, they would then go on to celebrate the Lord's Supper and receive the fullness of Jesus in the breaking of the bread. There's one echo of this still in the church, and it is in the Easter Vigil. The Easter Vigil, when we start Easter Sunday in the Catholic Church, the service is to begin sometime after sunset, before sunrise. And the proclamation of Easter should occur as close to sunrise as possible. And in the full form, you have 10 readings from the Old Testament and the New Testament, each with a response and a prayer, and you would have a reading, a period of silence, a response done by all the people, then a little bit of silence again, and then a prayer for everybody to pray, and then the priest praying in everybody's name. Well, that would take a long time. That's how they did, preparing themselves eagerly for Jesus to come. So, the view of Paul and of Mark, pretty much, is that Jesus is around the corner, and what we got to do after he fills us is wait for him to complete us. Luke and Matthew introduce a very, very different picture. For them, we have a mission. Matthew doesn't have it very strong. It's just, you really get our mission put very clearly in the very last paragraph of his gospel. Full authority. I have conquered death. I have also been received into heaven. Full authority in heaven and on earth is mine now. Go. That's the mission, that's Pentecost. You have his Spirit, we have his Spirit, we also have his mission. Go therefore. So what are we supposed to do until Jesus comes back? We're supposed to go. How? Where? We're supposed to go make disciples all the nations, or preach to all the nations, disciplizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Spirit. No, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Spirit. Go therefore, I'm having trouble with that quote, and I say it that often, It's easy to find. You just look to the end of his gospel. Full authority has been given to me both in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples. Disciplize all the nations. Baptize them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Spirit. Receive them into your community. So first go and have them start following me. Then receive them into the community with baptism. Let them immerse themselves fully in Father, Son, and Spirit. And then finally, teach them to carry out everything I've commanded you, and know that I am with you always until the end of the world. So the church has a mission to everybody, a mission to all of the nations, to the pagans, to disciplize them, to make them disciples, to preach to them, to baptize them, and when they're baptized, they're going to start experience healing, and therefore to continue this healing, and then after this, to continue this healing by teaching. But it isn't a very strong thing in Matthew. It is in Luke. Luke writes two books, the Gospel and Acts. The life of the Spirit of Jesus in living in Jesus, the life of the Spirit of Jesus living in the early church. From the day almost it starts with Jesus risen, spending a short time with the 12, and then ascending into heaven and then sending the Spirit down. Going from there until Paul arrives in Rome, which is the Spirit of Jesus has now arrived in the capital of the pagan world, so therefore in a symbolic way is everywhere. Two books. This is crucial. The mission of the church is not relegated to one sentence at the end of the gospel. The mission of the church is equal to the mission of Jesus. The Spirit acting in the historical Jesus and the Spirit acting in the church receive an equal amount of space. And there's the church, what the church does is seen to be a duplicate of what Jesus is doing again and again and again. Same patterns to healing. Jesus goes upstairs and brings a dead person, the dead girl, back to life. Paul goes upstairs. Paul's preaching, and he puts somebody to sleep, and the person fell off a rafter and was killed, and Paul comes and lays over the person, brings them back to life. There's imitations of miracles. So what we have is Luke telling us that what is occurring in the church, by the very fact that he devotes a whole book to writing it, is equal to what was occurring in Jesus. What I mean by that is it is the same Spirit, and therefore one whole mission. It began with Jesus, but it continues in the church. We're not just waiting around marking time. After Jesus resurrects, he spends 40 days with the church. At the beginning of the book of Acts, this is what we're told. 40 days with us. That's a symbolic number for all of the time we need. The first Israel spent 40 years in the wilderness before they enter the promised land. God prepared them for the promised land. Jesus spends 40 days with the new Israel finishing his work, so that when he ascends, everything that he must do for them is done. He's completed his work. Then he ascends to heaven, and in the book of Acts, chapter 1, verses 8 and 11, I'll read two verses to you. I'm going to read them backward, the verse 11 first. When Jesus is gone, the disciples are looking up to the heavens, missing Jesus. And the messengers from the tomb, two messengers from the tomb in Luke, angels, are back again. And they say, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand here looking up at the skies?" In other words, why are you looking where Jesus has gone, waiting for him to come back? You've got a mission. So that first position, that position of Paul and Mark, isn't enough. You can't just wait around for Jesus to come back the way the Thessalonians did, no matter how eager you are for Jesus to complete it. Your yearning for Jesus to complete it is understandable, but don't look up to the heavens because you have work to do on the earth. The full thing isn't here, but before Jesus ascends, his last words in Luke is, you're going to receive power. Now, Jesus is speaking to you and to me. When the Holy Spirit comes down on you, now that's happened. It happened in our baptism for the church that Luke is writing for. It happened at Pentecost. Then you are to be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and all of the world. Yes, even to the ends of the earth. So, all over. Jerusalem, the little section around Jerusalem is Judea, and then crossing over to the hated Samaritans, and then the ends of the world. The reason Luke has Jesus say this is the way the gospel did spread. Started in Jerusalem, then went to Judea. From there it went to Samaria, and finally it spread all over. Here's its first jump to those who aren't good Jews, and here's the big jump to those who are pagans. Luke is summarizing here then, here's a brief statement in that verse 8 of the history of how the church carried out its mission. But there's some questions. Why did the church become missionary? Why did Luke understand, or how did Luke come to experience this? Of course, it's the Spirit of Jesus is for everybody. But there's practical problems. And the very practical problem is that the first converts to Jesus, his disciples, in all probability are non-missionary Jews. How do non-missionary Jews, touched by the Spirit of Jesus, become a missionary church? A church that feels it is sent to everyone and can never be at rest until the good news that Jesus Christ is Lord is offered to every single person on this earth. What happens to make this change? And it isn't just they're filled with the Spirit and they throw open the doors and go out and start preaching to everybody. If you read the book of Acts, certain great things, certain traumatic things have to happen to sort of kick the church out of Jerusalem and start making it missionary. Because, very basically, the 12, I'll give you two words, the leaders of the church are not apostolic. Because they're Jews. And if you weren't here, just to remind you of this, basically you become a Jew by having the blood of Abraham. And since you can't preach to somebody that they ought to go out and get the blood of Abraham from their dad, there is no deep reason for the Jewish community to be missionary. The word apostle is one sent. That's the root, okay? That's missionary. Jesus calls us to follow him, and then he sends us. Well, the 12, the first disciples of Jesus, are very definitely not apostolic at all. As a matter of fact, I want to look at these two words a moment to share something with you. We talk about the 12 apostles. The New Testament doesn't, except for Luke in his gospel and in Acts. The New Testament talks about the 12, and we've lost this, and I want to briefly remind you of this. In the Gospel according to Mark, in chapter 6, chapter 3, Jesus, from all of his disciples, appoints, and the phrase is, the 12. He just doesn't appoint 12. He appoints the 12. And then Mark will refer to them this way. And then later on in chapter 6, he sends out the 12. And there is no word apostle in there. Matthew has exactly the same thing. Matthew takes this over. And in chapter 9, Jesus appoints the 12 disciples. He'll just throw the word disciple on, but the great phrase is the 12. then he will send out 12 apostles, but it's a different thing. The word apostle in that sentence isn't important. Then later on, there's another reference to the 12 disciples coming back and Jesus being with Jesus. The phrase, and there's an echo of this in John, in the New Testament, there is not an identification between the 12 and being apostles, except for Luke. And we bought Luke completely on this. There are a lot more apostles, as I hope to show you in a moment. This wouldn't be necessary to tell you, except you lose something if you don't understand how important the title the 12 is. God, in the Old Testament, entered the life of Abraham to prepare for himself a people. Abraham had Isaac. Isaac had Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons. And each of those sons was felt to be the patriarch, the father of a clan. And so Israel is composed of the sons of Jacob. Jacob's name is Israel. It's changed. So all of those who are sons of Israel, and there are 12, so there's 12 tribes, everybody would have sort of a great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpappy somewhere or other who would be a son of Israel. And that became the symbol, very, very symbolic, very, very important in Jewish thought. Jesus is the new Israel. Matthew make such a big point of that, and we've shared that. He has 12 sons. Followers of rabbis were called the sons of the rabbi. Those, therefore, who are following Jesus are the sons of the new Israel. And Jesus wants to show that he is establishing a new community, a community that'll last forever, that will go right into the last days. And so he selects 12 and he appoints them. And he says in chapter 19 that the 12 who start following him, Jesus, when he receives all authority from the Father and he comes on his throne, and it's God's throne that he's sharing, he's going to give the 12 thrones. And they are going to share with him in his role in judging the people. Now, judge here is the Old Testament word. It isn't judge the way we do. Guilt or innocence, it's a one who is ruling God's people, one who's leading God's people. So the 12 will share in the very power of Jesus over his people. Remember, however, that for Jesus, power is power to love. As Jesus loves everyone, the 12 have a very important role to be instruments of that love being offered people. The number is crucial so that when Judas stops following Jesus, he must be replaced. And the book of Acts gives us the story of the election, where after the resurrection, the very first thing after the ascension, the 11 get together and Matthias is selected. They first submit two names, but they cannot elect one. They must fill out the number 12 again. But Jesus can alone do that, so they use lots, sort of a form of gambling, trusting in God to make the actual selection. Only man can't select the person who's going to be sharing with Jesus his throne. Only Jesus can do that. So this couldn't be a full election. The final choice had to be somehow left to God, and therefore they've got to use lots. So this number is filled out. Once, however, they've elected Matthias, the number 12 is full. Death can't empty that number. They never appoint someone to be part of the 12. Because in the book of Acts, we're told the story that one of the 12 clearly is martyred. James the Apostle, the brother of John, is martyred by Herod. That's told pretty far into the book, chapter 12. He's not replaced.
Why? Because his role is a role to be with Jesus when Jesus comes to perfect his kingship.
When the new is, it's already started,
so he has a role now, but the church will always carry that on, and then he's going to be part of the great completion of everything.
It will be partially through him that Jesus will love everybody. He will share his throne. So he has passed on to where Jesus is. And he doesn't have to be replaced. He has remained loyal. He has remained a true son of Jesus right to the point of death, accepting martyrdom.
There's no need to replace him. So the 12 remind us of two things. That we're part of a new Israel. A whole new way of living. Secondly, that because we are part of the community based on the 12, we have a mission to rule and to judge the world. To rule the world the way Jesus does, with love. To look at this whole world and love it in its imperfection. Love it in its sin. At the same time, going to the technical word judge, we have a mission to be with the 12 in judging the world. And telling those who are living for power, who are living for sex, who are living for prestige, that there is something better by the way we love them. To judge the inadequacy of the way they're living by the way we try to live. Now that's part of what the phrase the 12 means. Against that, on the other side, are those who are apostles. The apostles are those who are sent with a special commission. The real word means, like, if I just send you somewhere, I say, you know, get out of my sight. Why don't you go to the movie? That doesn't make